so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we are doing this again. It's time for another toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. And, Matt, we can't keep on what? Tuesday, Wednesday, usually?
Yeah.
So, Prince dying on Thursday.
Yeah.
Massively inconvenient for all of us.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it.
I've been on vacation, but I left Thursday, which was it felt like the worst time to be leaving Minneapolis. Like, remember there was a time that I wanted to be here in downtown Minneapolis. It was as the city came together in really stunning fashion to celebrate the man's life and career.
Yeah, and I mean, there's no one who's more Minneapolis than Prince. I mean, he, among the many, many wonderful things about him, he was a real loyalist to his home.
And yeah, in a way that few artists are, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like almost in the way that, like, LeBron James is now sort of identified with, like, Cleveland, you know what I mean?
Yeah, except,
Prince,
like,
is Minneapolis. He never left. Well, except that he never left.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Prince would never have done something like The Decision. Whereas LeBron, I think, enjoys the storyline of going home. And I'm not, you know, I'm sure there are things about going back to Cleveland that are going home to him. For him, I think it's more about optics. For Prince, it was, I mean, that was his home. And for God's sakes, in his big movie, he made a lady purify herself in the waters of his lake. In his hometown.
Yeah.
Like, the guy was wildly committed.
You know, we have more than one lake here. There's like
10,000, I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost close to 11, actually.
I was not attempting to diminish your lakiness.
We brought on the Minnesota Tourism Board as our new sponsor, so I felt obligated.
Fair point. But no, I mean, I'm not sure I can think of another artist so closely identified with their hometown.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, maybe Springsteen and Asbury Park or whatever.
Yeah, but I think that's really mostly because he had an album called Asbury Park. I mean, the guy is not, it's not like he's going around trumpeting New Jersey and you know, going back to New Jersey after every tour to his palatial New Jersey mansion and talking about how great New Jersey is. Like, I just don't. Especially,
I think he does all of those things. I think he lives in New Jersey and talks a lot about how great New Jersey is.
Right. That's probably true, but it's still, I don't think of that as an essential part of who Bruce Springsteen is.
Maybe.
It's just not the same to me. And maybe that's because New Jersey is garbage, but that's not really.
Yeah. New Jersey is a pretty essential part of Bon Jovi, too. I mean, not comparing the artistic merits of Prince and Bon Jovi, but certainly they were contemporary. Right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of it, too, is
they also had an album called New Jersey, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I have no idea. I'm not on top of Bon Jovi album titles, but I do think there's something different when you're a Prince and you have the kind of impact, not just musically, but socially, that he did, and you are the kind of outsized character. I mean, in many ways, when we think of Prince, it makes more sense to think of him as an alien than being from any U.S. city, and yet he is essentially tied to Minnesota, of all places, which is not, it's not hip, no offense, and it's also it's also not really near anything, you know. I mean, New Jersey is essentially a New York suburb, and
well, look, but isolation. I mean, you know, that's a big part of the Seattle myth, and certainly there's been, you know, music, whether it be Prince or the Replacements or Who's Her Do, you know, like really influential music that came out of here. I think he's maybe somewhat bred by that isolation and, you know, the fact that, you know, the weather here 5 months out of the year, but, you know, is conducive to you locking yourself in a basement and playing guitar all day long. So,
yeah, that's a true story.
You know, and I think that was true about Prince. And, you know, one of the things I really love, you know, about going back to look at his life is I think people, one of the things that really came to the fore about Prince is just the musicianship. You know, you realize just what a transcendent guitar player he was.
Oh, man.
But also insanely talented beyond that, played 40 instruments.
Oh, my God. I saw his piano and a mic tour. And by the way, I feel incredibly lucky to have been able to do that. And also, boy, am I glad I didn't opt to be cheap because it was a pricey ticket. He was unbelievable with quite literally a piano and a microphone. There was one time when he did, in one of the encores, I believe, he played When Doves Cry and had like a backing track coming out of the piano, which definitely had some souped up electronic elements. But mostly it was just him and a piano and a microphone. And first of all, he's a tremendous pianist. I mean, and no partial pun intended. He was phenomenal. Flourishes and beautiful harmonic. I mean, everything you would expect from a world-class piano player, except, of course, playing Prince songs, which is much better than your average piano recital.
Right.
Just the musicianship. He was virtuoso level on the guitar, and I did not see anything to make me think he was any less incredible of a piano player when I watched him just about a month ago. So
I saw somebody tweet a cover story of Prince from Bass Player magazine, which is, you know, it's 100% full-on music nerd readership. You know what I mean?
Of course.
You don't make the cover of Bass Player magazine for being famous. You make it for being a badass bassist. And there are probably, I don't know, seven other instrument magazines could have been covered up too. Like, it was just great, you know?
And essentially self-taught on all of it.
Mm-hmm. And all of the clips that you see going around of Prince and you know, there are a lot of similar ones because he was so fastidious about digital rights and whatnot.
Yep.
But they're just amazing. And what just strikes you is that musicianship combined with that easy charisma and the naturalist, you know, way that he could play and just be a showman. It's really, I don't know that we'll ever see a combination like that again.
No.
You know, you and I think both talked about the, that performance of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that kind of went around where he's doing, now, you know, I gotta say, I thought you were a little hard on Tom Petty over there with the boring old white guy's comment.
Well, it's all relative.
I watched the clip, and, like, if you haven't seen it yet, they're doing While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and, like, George Harrison's kids out there with Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty and
Winwood.
I don't know. Winwood's in the mix. And they're kind of doing their standard, you know, Beatles cover thing, and it's fine and whatever. And Prince is there, and he's playing along. He's kind of off sort of stage right. And then all of a sudden, in time for Prince to solo, and he just walked towards the middle and just lights the song on fire. And, like, poor Tom Petty is just, like, sitting there with this, like, shitty grin on his face, trying to figure out what he could, like, interject with some woo-woos or something, but, like, not even really knowing what to do with it.
Yep.
And he just destroys it. And then the song ends, and Prince twirls the guitar around, throws it up in the air, walks off stage, does not look at any of the other Rock and Roll Hall of Famers.
Yeah, so a few things about that. First of all, you didn't even, I don't think you even conveyed the impact of the solo, because first of all, it goes on probably as long as the rest of the song. And I got the feeling that Prince never told anyone exactly how long of a solo he was going to take. Because you do get to a point where everyone's kind of looking at him like, is this, are we just going to, we're going to keep, okay, we're going to keep going. And then the other thing you left out is in the middle of the solo, he walks to the front of the stage, faces the band, falls backwards off the stage, and has a security guard lift him back up, all while soloing, all while playing the guitar. And when he tosses the guitar in the air at the end, you never see it again. He just throws it into the air and walks off, and it's unclear, did it come down? Did it just slowly rise up to rock and roll heaven? Was there like a special security guard somewhere that he instinctively tossed it to? Because he's not even really looking where he throws it. It's the most wild, like rock godlike performance. And that's especially noteworthy for a couple things for me. Number one, because I think, you know, maybe the average American who's not a big music head looks at that stage and goes, it's a bunch of rock guys, and then that little guy who likes to shake his ass. And then the little guy who likes to shake his ass is an infinitely better rock musician than any of those other Hall of Famers. And here's the last thing about it. The sort of apocryphal rumored story goes, Prince showed up late. Tom Petty gave him some crap backstage, like, respect the process, how dare you show up late, we're all Hall of Famers. And that's why Prince did that, never really looked at Tom Petty, and then just walked off the stage.
Oh, even better. Even better.
And when you hear that, it certainly fits what you see. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, who knows if that's true, but if it is true, it's like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. That's what that looks like, and that fits with everything I know about Prince.
The other legendary show, and I've seen some of this pass around. I don't know if you've seen any of
this. The Capitol Theater?
Prince, so, you know, Saturday Night Live, not that long ago.
Oh, yeah.
40th anniversary show. Of course, Saturday Night Live is famous for not just the show, but for the after party.
Right.
So they had an epic after party. And Prince was the musical guest. Now, this is literally a room, maybe the greatest single collection of famous people in one room over the last 4 years.
It's up
there.
You
know what I mean? Like,
yep.
You remember who's on the show. Like, it was a who's who, plus everybody that had been on the show, all these things, you know. And Prince has the entire place just eating out of the palm of his hand. You know, I saw a performance where he's doing... Let's Go Crazy, you know, you've got on stage half the cast of Saturday Night Live, and oh my God, I'm blanking on her name, the girl who played Donatella Versace, Maya Rudolph, thank you.
I'm not really a Saturday Night Live guy.
Maya Rudolph, who, by the way, has a Prince cover band called Princess.
That's amazing.
It's like freaking out. You know, Fallon's up there. Chris Rock is up on stage. Cuba Gooding, like, runs on there, takes a selfie. You know, Wynn Butler from the Arcade Fire is, like, lurking in the background, like, trying to sing backup. You know, Emma Stone is on tambourine. And, like, just people just wanted to be, like, really, really famous people just wanted to be near Prince. He was the guy that owned the room. And, you know, it's interesting to me, like, you know, obviously, people sort of want to compare now that they're both gone, you know, Prince and Michael Jackson. They were always contemporaries and rivals in some way. And I feel like people who may just be paying less attention to music may not see them as equals. I know I heard Tony Kornheiser or Anisha. I enjoyed listening to Tony. You know, he's coming from a grandpa musical perspective.
Yeah.
Was, like, really sort of surprised that anyone would compare Prince and Michael Jackson as pop stars. And I think unless you were looking, you know, the second you get out of the realm of record sales, because, I don't think there's any question that Michael Jackson had more hits than Prince and maybe even bigger hits, you know?
He had bigger hits. Did he have more hits?
Yeah, I think almost definitively you have to say he had more hits.
All right.
There were like 7 hits on Thriller alone. You know what I mean?
I know, but neither of their later work was especially hitty.
Yeah, yeah. But
I mean, Prince, how many hits on Purple Rain? At least three.
Not seven.
Well, but at least you know three beyond massive singles, and yeah, you're probably right. Michael probably has the edge there, but I think some of that has to do with Michael, by his own nature, being a little more pandery than Prince.
Maybe, yeah. Look, I'm not, you know, you also have to consider that Michael Jackson started making hit records at six.
Yeah, at 3 years old, yeah. No, so, and also, by the way, this is a winner's, you know, sword fight. I mean, it's not, they're both incredible.
Yeah. But, you know, to me, like, I guess the point that I was going to make was that, you know, once you get out of that lens of just, hey, who had more hits,
right,
and you start looking at legacy, you know, I mean, Michael was a better dancer than Prince, and yeah. I think I would give Prince just about the edge, just about everything else. You know what I mean? Like, that combination of, you know, musical talent and the synthesis of all of these various genres and just the impact on people, you know, and the style and, you know, his impact on culture and sex and his ability, like, to be really mainstream but push buttons.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, honestly, you know, you could say a lot of the things about Prince that you could say, you know, that we said when David Bowie died. And in a lot of ways, you could make the case that he was the American David Bowie, you know?
That's exactly the case that I would make. And when you say Michael Jackson, that was my first thought, is he's really more Bowie than Jackson. Michael, and here's why. I think everything you just said is pretty spot on. Obviously, Michael's dancing is transcendent. You can't mess with that. But when it came to the actual music, I do think Prince has the edge in virtually every category. I mean, I love both of their singles. I think they're both, you know, two of the five greatest pop stars in the history of the world. But Prince is a better musician. Prince, in my view, is a better songwriter.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Michael co-wrote a lot of those songs.
And Prince.
Some didn't write at all. Prince was giving away songs to people.
I mean, he Manic Monday was literally a pickup line.
Yeah.
Like, he wrote a huge single just to try to pick up Susanna Hoffs. Like, dude, do you realize how much of a genius you have to be to write Manic Monday just because you're like, man, I need a way in the door with this chick. I guess I'll write a huge hit song, and then she'll probably go out with me. Like, oh my God. And yep. You know, the reason though that he becomes Bowie is this, you know, box defining behavior, whether it's the Minnesota stuff or it's his incredible being incredibly sensual and sexual while also being sort of androgynous and confusing, defining, redefining, allowing everyone to define for themselves things like masculinity and what's cool, mm-hmm. and what appropriate straight behavior might be or whatever. All these boxes and confinements that I think a lot of times we ask our art, music, you know, from music to movies to painting to literature, we ask our art to smash these boxes for us. And Prince is one of the most box-smashing artists in the history of the world. And I don't think his impact can be overstated.
Yeah, and you know, you can't even see the box. And it's one of those things where, like, you wouldn't even someday we'll have another Prince, right? You know what I mean? Like he was so singular.
I don't know how you could. Yeah, I mean, hopefully we'll have other people with the same greatness, but you will never have another Prince. Never.
Yep. Yeah. It's a shame he's gone.
It's a real shame. Way too soon, by the way. So young. And you know, part of that, too, is the way the world works now. I'm not sure a singular artist can unify the people in the way that some of these folks who have passed away recently did. Whether that's, you know, I guess Michael Jackson isn't that recently, but he falls into that category. Bowie falls into that category. There's so many options. There's such a diversity of entertainment now. I'm not sure you can centralize things enough. Certainly, without being a little broader than these musicians were. I mean, Prince is pretty specific. He had a wild, broad talent, can do a million things, but he is a pretty odd and specific musical artist in a lot of ways, and I'm not sure, without being an incredibly broad, easy-to-listen-to thing, I don't know if you can capture that many eyes and ears anymore.
No, that may be true. And maybe this is a good point to pivot to, if there is anyone with sort of the broad coalition appeal to, capture just the widest possible swath of American audience today, and that person would be Queen Bee.
Yeah.
Beyonce dropped a new record this week, is record even the right word? A new video album?
It's an album, and I think that's noteworthy. And before we get into it, though, quickly, I wanna throw something at the wall with you, based on our Prince discussion, and based on, I mean, it feels like we've done too many obituaries. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's been. I mean, we're only in April.
Yeah, and really, the last like five months, and I think part of it, and I don't know if you agree with me on this, but I think part of it is our age. We are getting to a point where the people that were huge when we were little are into the danger territory life-wise.
Prince was 57.
Well, Prince is not the best example of that, you're right, but I mean, and even Bowie wasn't that old, but still, like, you get to your late 50s and, like, it's different than being in your 30s or 40s. You're starting to become an old person, and it starts to become an issue. And, you know, I mean, there was Glenn Frey, and not that I'm a huge Glenn Frey fan, but, like, people of that era have started to pass on more frequently. Anyway, that's not really where I wanted to go. Just that with all this Prince stuff, I saw a couple of people say, via Twitter or otherwise, something to the effect of, why don't we celebrate people until they die? And while I don't think Prince lacked for celebration during his life, I kind of agree with that idea. So I tried to come up, I was thinking about, like, can we do something that's not too morbid? That's like the sort of conversation.
Like, appreciate this person while they're still around?
Yeah, an alivetuary. That was what I decided to call it. What do you think about alivetuaries?
All right. We could do a, or a not deadtuary.
Yeah, not yet deadtuary sounds a little morbid again. But we can throw that back and forth. But it was a thought I had because, and again, I certainly had conversation similar to this about Prince, a different tone, but I raved plenty about Prince during his life.
Yeah,
same goes for Michael Jackson. But
I think being here, you know, where literally everyone has a Prince story and they're all amazing.
Like, right.
Everyone's Prince story is fantastic. And, you know, he was here and, you know, playing parties at his house that you
right.
could go to so often. Like, people really did rave about him all the time here.
Yeah. This is not so much about Prince as it is about, like, I think it was Ninth Wonder, the hip-hop producer, who had the one that was that hit me the most about just people deserve this treatment during their life. And so I was thinking we should try doing that.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right.
Let's talk Beyonce.
Yes, let's go to Beyonce, now that I have that off my chest.
What was yours? So I have yet, I was out, right? Lemonade was on HBO one night, and now, do I have to go to Tidal to get it now? Because if that's the case, then I'm not going to bother.
You have to go to Tidal, or you have to buy the album on iTunes or Amazon.
Okay.
And I'll
say
this.
Have you watched it?
Yes, I have.
And are you parsing issues of her relationship with Jay-Z? Are you just watching it as like, holy f***, this is weird and great, and I love it?
Definitely the latter, in part. Here's what I would say. As far as the marital concerns go, who cares? Because I can't decide, and I have thought about this probably more than a 34-year-old man should have at this point. I find it fascinating whether this is a confessional and it's getting stuff off of her chest and it's all straight out of her life. But maybe more fascinating if it's a complete fabricated concept album.
I think it's almost certainly a complete fabricated concept album, because she's not a very confessional artist by nature.
But also
she's not a person that gives a lot of herself.
Well, but that's part of the question. Has that changed? Because even when Formation came out, which is the last track on the album, I think for a lot of people, obviously for Republican politicians, it was like, whoa, Beyonce's being real, and this is like, she's talking about serious stuff and trying to speak to people. Whoa.
And right. It was mildly surprising that Beyonce was engaged in the world in some way.
Right. Like,
she of all artists, of all modern pop stars, doesn't she seem the most like kind of in an ivory tower?
Yeah. And I think she's done that deliberately. But also, she's my age. Here's what we have to keep in mind.
Pop off of that ivory tower.
Beyonce is my age, which is to say 34. She came into the spotlight as, what, an 18-year-old? Something like that?
I don't know.
Very young. And in a group. And then she sort of busted out of that group and did some cool pop stuff.
Busted makes me feel good, man.
What?
I said busted makes me feel good.
Oh. There you go.
All right, you're 34. You don't have any Ghostbusters references.
No, I've seen Ghostbusters. I like Ghostbusters. Okay. I don't know that it necessarily, other than the word bust, had anything to do with what I was saying. But look, my point is essentially like, would it be so crazy if the point in Beyonce's journey of popular culture where she got real was around her early to mid 30s? That would not be that weird to me, and I think that's a reasonable explanation, and that she decided that to progress she needed to be more personal. I think already her the other video album thing that she released, which was a couple years ago now, I think had already sort of gone to a graphic sexual place that she hadn't previously explored, you know, and in many ways I feel like this is a multiple year process of Beyonce stepping into a different sort of a role where she's not an ivory tower pop princess and she's an artist, you know, and she co-wrote everything on this album. My understanding is she sort of co-produced and co-designed the movie. I think she deserves more credit as a musical artist than I've been giving her anyway, which, you know, might not be saying much, but I was super, super impressed. And again, for me, the question of whether this is complete artistic artifice or whether it's deeply personal and confessional, it's almost more interesting to have the discussion about which it is than it is to know the answer. And I mean, how awesome would it be if it's totally made up, but then Jay-Z comes back with like his album where he goes through the same things of like, I was cheating on you and then I got caught and then we fought but we reconciled. Like, that's essentially what the album is like, go to hell, you cheating bastard, I'm trying to accept that you're still part of my family, I'm trying to forgive you, we're okay. And if that's real and Jay-Z makes his own side of it in an album, that's incredible. If it's fake and Jay-Z makes his own sort of second act of the opera via an album. Incredible. I don't really care.
I just want to pose a scenario to you, and I'm not saying that this is what happened. But let's take this into the hypothetical for a second. Let's say you were one of those, you know, Borg-like people that, you know, Illuminati-type people, you know, the elites, and you wanted to relate to the common man. You know what I mean? If you wanted to put out a piece of art, you know, piece of art that said, I know that I seem like I am, you know, from Planet Celebrity, but I live just like you. Wouldn't an album in which you were a protagonist, you got cheated on, and then but then you came to terms and you found a way to forgive, like, wouldn't you find that to be as much of a quote-unquote relatable scenario as really you could?
That's a deeply interesting question on a lot of levels, but I'm going to try to ignore those to go along with what you're doing here. And I'm not saying
that's what happened, but I'm just saying that if that's what you would do, right? Something like that.
I guess. for me, she's under no... you're right. Maybe you would, but... But I guess the question I would ask you, if that's your theory, and I realize it may not be, it's just a theory. But if that is your theory,
I'm not positing that.
No, I understand. I understand. Yeah. But I'm just saying.
But like, I do think it's possible.
Sure, but for the sake of argument, if that's your theory, I would like to know the answer to the question of why she's interested in relating in the first place.
I think because. You know, you have to, don't you? Don't you? To maintain some sort of audience and fans and connection? And...
I guess, but she hasn't to this point, and she's been just fine. I mean, Michael Jackson...
she certainly has. Don't you think Single Ladies was a song that attempted to do that?
Well, in the way any silly pop song does, but I don't think there's anything... There's nothing confessional or personal about that. And even if your argument is, well, there's nothing confessional or personal about this either, if it's made up, that's somewhat true, but the subject matter is still intense, and it still requires emoting. And obviously, they knew when they released this that there would be rampant speculation. So
right.
This was going to be a thing where everyone was talking about their relationship publicly, which is a thing that, based on past behavior, doesn't seem like something Beyonce's thrilled about. And you know, it's also like if we're looking at Beyonce as like an ego-filled Illuminati Borg person, then I don't imagine this would be something she would want people to be talking about and thinking about and speculating about, you know, all the infidelities of her husband and whatnot. So, of course, that's possible.
If you're an Illuminati Borg person, like, aren't you above the speculation of the general populace? Here's the thing. Sorry, so, you know, because my initial reaction to this was, I'm not interested in Beyonce's personal life. But then I thought about the incident with Solange in the elevator.
Yeah, that's what everyone has thought about.
Right, and I was fascinated by that. Like, 100% fascinated by that. So... clearly, I am interested in Beyonce's personal life, like many people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do think it's entirely possible that they looked at, like, well, here's the thing, we can get up talking, and we can, you know, exploit is a strong word, but we can, let's just say, leverage that for not even necessarily commercial purposes, maybe just a fertile artistic ground, you know? But it does strike me as highly possible that this is a calculated move on her part.
Yeah, but again, I that doesn't bother me a ton. It may be, but to me, that's almost as interesting because I have to tell you, have you heard any of the songs or you haven't watched it? Have you heard?
I mean, other than Formation, I'm pretty much flying blind.
Yeah, I would listen to it because. Even if everything you just theorized or...
Oh, you know what? You know, I heard the Ezra Koenig song.
Hold Up, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even that song, which is one of the less personal ones on the album, I would say, First of all, I love it. I think it sounds great. Second of all, her voice is... I mean, you knew she had a good voice, but it's incredibly versatile. She does a lot of different things, singing-wise. And I really think beyond just most, if not all, of the music being really interesting and quite good, the video thing was so well tied together. I mean, I do think this album, there's more to this album than there has been to Beyoncé in the past, if that makes sense. When I finished watching the video, I was both entertained and impressed. And if this... if it's all made up... I mean, I think this is a question we probably can ask ourselves in general. If it is all artifice and an attempt, storyline-wise, to relate to the common man, is that any less of an impressive artistic achievement if it works and it's good? Is that any less impressive or artistically worthwhile than if it was completely real?
No, I'm not saying it's not. There's no judgment in me saying that this might be a calculated move. In fact, I'd almost respect that more.
Right, and I'm not hearing it that way, but that's kind of my point is, you'd almost respect it more. And if she sort of created this entire thing in her mind, well, what an impressive mind that must be.
Indeed. All right, can I give you my Beyoncé hot take? Can I bring in some judgment now?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I know you're a huge fan. Like you're
not,
in the
actually.
Tank for Beyoncé.
That's what's interesting. I like some Beyoncé. I had no particular attachment to her.
Interesting.
I thought Formation.
You were pretty effusive during the discussion about Coldplay and the Super Bowl and a couple times now.
Well,
pretty,
I did
generous in your praise for Beyoncé.
I Formation is the origin of that. The Formation, the way that was released, and the video, and the Super Bowl performance—that was the inception of my apparent fanaticism of Beyoncé. Before that, I have Crazy in Love in my music library, and I'll throw down on a dance floor to Bootylicious, but I'm not a Beyoncé diehard before the music from this album, and I have to say. First of all, you don't get the full songs in the video. The full songs are awesome. The Kendrick Lamar song is phenomenal. And, of course, Kendrick's verse is a part of that. But the song she wrote with Jack White, I think, is killer. I'm just impressed. Musically and artistically, I have... This is recent. I am not a longtime Beyoncé veteran.
Okay. Now, it's interesting that you bring that up, then. Because my sort of point was like, I'm always going to applaud, someone who has that kind of mainstream success and sort of creative capital with the fans, like taking that and really using that to take chances,
and to expand their own musical sort of, world and try to expand ours as a culture.
And I'm good on that, but like the reason that I ride for Bay, or the reason that I have rode for Bay in the past, is because I think that Single Ladies and Crazy in Love, are transcendent songs. You know what I mean? That you are just kind of like almost impossible to resist, and you sort of remember them forever. She even had a couple of those in Destiny's Child. I thought, Say My Name comes on, and I am still like, I'll give you every word to Say My Name, and that song is coming up on 20 years old. Like,
and you're an adult man.
Yeah, and I'm an adult man, and there are those are classic contributions, right? And it's. When you start thinking about it, it's kind of been a while since she had a song that contributed sort of to that legacy. Do you know what the last Beyoncé number one hit was? Number one U.S. hit? Do you know what it was?
Wow. No, I don't.
The answer is Single Ladies.
Really?
In 2008.
That was Single Ladies was after Crazy in Love?
Yeah, sure was.
Huh.
Sure was.
Okay.
Crazy Love was 2003.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah. Now,
oh my God, I'm so old. Why are you doing this to me?
Now, Drunken Love did go to number two.
And that was huge, yeah.
But it's been a lot of singles. It's been a lot of singles. And I don't know that they're... It doesn't, you know, at least from what I've heard of it. Obviously, you spent way more time with them than I have.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure that there's a number one single coming from this album. And I don't think that's what she's going for. I'm not saying that as a criticism of the album.
Right.
But you know what I mean? Like, it seems like she's taking herself out of that game a little bit. And I, we need Beyonce up on that wall. Like,
do we?
You know, I spent some time listening to it. Yeah, like, if you spent any time listening to one of the three top 40 stations that are in your town lately?
Of course not.
Like, oh, man. Like, the you know, the top 40 is, like, some bland, like, Charlie Puth, like...
But why would you want Beyonce... But don't... To me, that's a reflection of Beyonce choosing the music over the popularity. And I would not want her to do anything differently. And frankly, if she did, I'm not sure it would fill the niche that you want. It would be...
It's not about chasing popularity. It's about songs that, you know, dazzle our collective imaginations. You know what I mean?
Well, but I'm not sure that's what's on a top 40 station anymore.
And that she used to be so good at that, you know? Like, Crazy in Love... You know, Single Ladies, those are universal songs. You know what I mean? And I just, I don't know. I don't, like, I'm all for her doing weird shit. I love weird shit. You know, I just don't totally want her to leave that behind. It's been a while since we've seen that Beyonce.
I'm not sure.
Like, you know, do you want her to be a Prince or do you want her to be a Michael Jackson? And I think she was kind of, you know, this current generation's Michael Jackson, you know?
Well, but when was Michael's last number one hit?
Oh, I actually looked this up. Hold on, I gotta hit the back button a couple times. Michael Jackson's last number one hit was You Are Not Alone in 1995.
So, that's 15 years between his last number one hit and his passing, right?
He put out what is the remix album? I won't count that. He put out three records, I guess, in that time. You know, yeah,
You're
Not Alone was on History, which had that scream, and that was kind of, that's essentially the end of Michael Jackson's run as a, you know, great pop star.
Right. And he was older at that point and had been in the public eye for a lot longer, but...
Yeah, at that point it had been, in 1995, it had been 24 years since his first hit.
But
that's a pretty good run.
Okay, but maybe let's look more at Dangerous, okay? Which is a huge album with great hits on it. But it was also, by Michael Jackson standards, pretty weird and pretty out there. And I think what allowed it to be a number one hit was that it was 1991 or whatever, and it was Michael Jackson. And because of the way the world worked at that point, if Michael Jackson put out a record, it was a huge hit, period, end of story. And the fact that he got a little weird and did some different things in Black or White, I mean, is that so different from what Beyonce's doing? I think it's...
No, it's exactly the same, actually.
The world is different.
Because Michael Jackson, right, I mean, what made Dangerous a number one record, despite it being weird, was that... You know, Michael Jackson videos in 1991
mm-hmm.
were an event, and MTV would play them every hour on the hour. It'd be such a big deal when he was coming out with a video, and there was this sort of visual hype train.
And the black or white video was amazing.
Right. Black or White was a, you know, groundbreaking video. Remember the Time was on that album. That was
amazing
also another
video
they spent. Right. So those are big deal things. And Beyonce is essentially, I think, trying to do the same thing.
How can
I break Twitter? You know, oh, well, we'll you know, surprise release this video album on HBO, you know.
Yeah, but I don't think there's a middle ground for her to tread. I think some of that just has to do with the way radio and the world works. First of all, I think there are songs on this album that will be on top 40 radio. Will they be number one hits? I don't know. But Hold Up is going to be on top 40 radio. The Jack White song, Don't Hurt Yourself, is going to be on top 40 radio, I bet. Or maybe rock radio, actually, more with that one. And
Rock radio is not going to play Beyonce.
I can tell you that.
Okay.
No matter how guitar-y the song is.
Pop rock radio? I mean, hard rock radio is not going to play it, but the same station that's playing, Maroon 5 might. I'm not sure there's a way to be a number one hit artist and also express yourself creatively in a meaningful way. I just don't know that you can do that in 2016.
I think isn't that the challenge to the great ones? And that's what Beyonce's aiming for, right?
Well, and I think to me, at a certain point, all she can do is make great music, and then if idiots don't like it enough to make it a number one hit, because that's what we're talking about. I mean, I think anyone who cares about music and enjoys this style of music will hear this album and enjoy it and think it is good and think it is interesting and think she has accomplished something.
For it to fail
to be a number one hit, those are dumb people. And if you can't get dumb people to listen to your good music, I don't really care.
Well, I think that's that's to me, like, it's not about dumb people. You know what I mean? It's about people who are invested in music and people who are less invested in music. People who listen to Top 40 radio and don't think much about, what records are coming out and don't, aren't that, just listen to what's kind of available to them. Like, that's stupid.
Well,
they're just not that invested in the whole thing.
I'm being narrow. They're not, you're right. Of course, they're not broadly idiotic people in general, but...
some of them are stupid. You take a slice of a million people, you're going to have a lot of stupid ones.
Let me be softer on this. People who have no real passion or interest in music, and I don't,
which by the way is most people,
I know. Well, most people also are stupid. Separate issues. But for me, your ability or inability to capture those people is near the bottom of the list in terms of what makes you successful or interesting as a musical artist.
Look, it's not to me solely what makes you successful or interesting as a music artist. There are a lot of things that capture the imagination of people that really have no merit whatsoever. But I do think that there is intrinsic value in being able to write songs that make people come together. I really do. And I don't think the Beatles, for example, would be the f-ing Beatles if they weren't a group that not only changed things but also captured the imagination of the entire music public. You know what I mean? Like, it's part of the deal, Same thing with most of the bands that you would consider legendary, I mean, Guns N' Roses isn't Guns N' Roses if they're just scuzzy dudes that people, that who are only into hard rock were interested in,
Can you give me...
There's a reason that, like, a band like, the New York Dolls or Iggy Pop, who were, groundbreaking, transcendent, and legendary in some ways, artists, Lou Reed, another one, for example... Like, there's a level that they're at that isn't in that elite circle of all-time greats, and that's the difference, right? The fact that their music didn't impact that many people,
Can you name me a musician or band that has reached that level who did not debut before the year 2000?
It means in terms of capturing the imagination of the world at large.
Yeah, like having that level of popular impact since in this millennium, which is, you've had time.
What are you saying, like, in terms of, like, just gotten really famous? Like, what do you mean by that level?
Well, I'm saying who's...
You're talking about combination of fame and influence?
Yeah, I'm talking about who fills that... Who does what you're asking Beyonce to do? Who is wildly popular and then is artistically interesting and still managing to create top 40 number one hits while being musically interesting?
Well, that's a good question. Kendrick Lamar was the first name that came to mind.
Yeah, but
Kanye. Kanye's the answer to that. What am I thinking?
Still predates the internet to a degree.
Yeah, to some degree.
Hit was what, 99? Kanye? I mean, his big breakout album?
Yeah. Look, Kanye's been around a minute and, certainly had some brand equity prior to that, which bring me back to you know, I mean, look, I think, you know, in terms of bringing people together, you know, I mean, you have to talk about Taylor Swift.
And yeah, I don't know that.
Look, Taylor Swift isn't quite as risky, obviously, artistically, as some of those people. But
That is you just gave Taylor Swift infinitely more credit than she has earned from a musically interesting standpoint.
I know, it's so weird because those people who know me know that I'm a Taylor Swift hater.
Taylor Swift is musically uninteresting.
But you have... Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I would not say that.
Her most recent album is by far the most interesting stuff she's done, if you ask me. It doesn't touch this Beyoncé album in any way.
You have to give her at least the credit of the fact that she has been willing to take chances with her fan base.
Has
hopped genres coming from a world in which genre hopping is almost expressly forbidden.
Wait, what, like, the country world? Yes, she hopped genres. She did not hop genres. She broadened her appeal. She became more broad in general.
I don't know. She made a new wave record. She wrote songs with the dude from Fun. You know what I mean? Like,
you mean the dude? When you say the dude from Fun, do you mean the dude who wrote one of the biggest pop songs of the last decade? Is that the dude that you're talking about? Is that so wild for her to work with one of the biggest pop songwriters in the world? I mean, come on.
She worked with Max Martin. After she made it famous.
No, after his song.
Are you talking about what? About the Fun song?
Yes.
He wasn't writing for other people until he started writing for Taylor Swift. But
he's a pop songwriter. Working with a pop songwriter is not going weird. It's not.
I don't want to make this about Taylor Swift because that's
I understand. But I'm saying I don't think she qualifies. Mm-hmm. I don't think she's edgy in any way.
We're not talking about edgy though.
We're talking about taking chances. Okay. Well, whatever you want to call it, she's not really taking chances when she goes from narrow country music stardom to broad pop stardom. She's broadening. Beyoncé is narrowing in a way, and also still huge, and also artistically interesting. And I would rather have someone with her platform try to be artistically interesting than try to broaden her appeal further.
Right. I'm not suggesting, I applaud people who take chances, and I'm glad that she's doing weird things.
Yeah,
you still got to put a hit on a record every once in a while, people stop caring. Yeah, I mean, look.
Well, I don't think this is hitless. I think there are hits on this record. But what you're talking about, being played on top 40 radio consistently, having a number one hit, that stuff to me is not... that is not and should not be in the domain of an artist. That's in the domain of a populist.
Well, but Taylor Swift is a great populist. You're confusing what I mean by that. Like, you know, having a single on top 40 radio is just a measure of the impact. What I'm talking about is creating songs that people are going to remember and sing.
Yeah, but
10 years from now.
Do you disagree? Maybe this is our fundamental disagreement. I feel like in order to create those songs, you have to shave off the sort of risks we're talking about. You have to eliminate the chance taking that we're discussing. In my view, the people that have those songs now in 2016 are people who are attempting to appeal to the broadest popular audience.
I would submit to you, Outkast is a perfect example of, no, you don't have to do that.
Outkast has it. Where's my 2016 Outkast record?
That'd be great. But what I'm saying is, like, you can write Hey Ya, which was a tremendous departure for that group, and have it be like a massive, massive number one song. You know what I mean?
Well,
and
even on a smaller level. I love
Jackson,
Hey Ya.
Or, you know what I mean?
I love Hey Ya, but A, that was 2003, same time Crazy in Love came out, which I think you could say is equally creative, and B, Hey Ya was undoubtedly a broadening and dumbing down of Outkast.
Right, but yeah, because I knew you would say that. I don't think, by the way, I don't think Hey I is a dumbing down of Outkast.
Okay, maybe it's not dumbing down, but it's broadening and popularizing. It deliberately steps.
You could say the same thing about Miss Jackson. You know what I mean? Like they still wrote classic songs. You know, within the context of being weird. You know what I mean?
But Miss Jackson was limited to the appeal of hip hop.
I mean, like. No, it was not. You put Miss Jackson on in a room full of non-hip hop people, you're going to get people singing on the chorus. You mean rock bands covered Miss Jackson?
But that's in the same way that you'd get people singing along to California Love, or I mean, it was a huge hip hop song, but it was a hip hop song, and did it explode past the appeal of hip hop somewhat? Of course it did. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's all I'm saying for Beyonce. I'm not saying she needs to make. A One Direction tune. I'm saying, needs to make a song that it invades the broader cultural consciousness. That's all I'm asking for. Like, don't forget those.
But how is that not happening with this record? I mean, I think that is happening with this record.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's way too early to tell.
I mean,
you spent more time with it than I have, but I, you know,
I'm not sure
from what I've heard. I don't know that I see that there yet. And it's been a minute since that's happened with her.
I'm not sure.
That was my whole point.
I'm not sure it has that mainstream appeal again of a Crazy in Love or a Hey Ya. But I think there are great singles on this album that are appealing and that will have, you know, some pop life to them.
Let's agree to check back on that.
Okay.
I just wanted to say something negative about Bang because I feel like there's literally some sort of law against that these days. Like, if there's anyone in pop culture with like universal approval rating, it's Beyonce.
Well,
and frankly, I'm sick of it.
Well, I think it speaks to what she's doing and how well she's doing it that she remains that person. And that she's able to do things like this, and I hope it continues. I guess that's how I would look at it. All right, before we finish here, there's a couple extra things, and in fact, we have not left ourselves the requisite time to talk about Game of Thrones at all.
Oh, really? I expected it, but I was really just meh. On the whole first episode. Like, it was Game of Thrones, and I'm happy it's back. And
sure.
I understand that the narrative weight of the story requires that you're going to need to do some setup.
I'm not sure I agree with that. So let me throw the... here's the sum of my notes. I'm going to skim my notes for you on Game of Thrones. First of all, reasons that I love the show and enjoyed this episode. The places where Sansa and Tyrion have found themselves are incredibly satisfying. I am thrilled that Sansa finally linked up with Brienne of Tarth, and that seems to be the, I hope, and certainly could be, the start of the Sansa Stark revenge story arc.
Yeah, that was definitely the most satisfying thing that happened in the episode.
That was awesome. Yeah. Tyrion sort of installing himself, being installed as the temporary ruler of Meereen, and seeing him get to play politics again, I'm very excited about. The Castle Black storyline overall, I think, is really cool. I love Davos. The without spoiling the twist with the Red Lady in the season premiere, I thought was interesting. But they are going to have to dispense. They're going to have to dispense with the lie of Jon Snow being dead sooner than later to keep from boring me. And I would say, lastly, on the good side, I am exhilarated, if somewhat terrified, of Cersei's upcoming revenge madness that is sort of hanging over things. And I have become a Jaime Lannister fan. I think the guy who plays him is really good, and I like his storyline of trying to figure out how to be a decent person in this his sort of hysterical, ridiculous world that he's living in.
Yeah, you know, now when I watch Jaime Lannister, I think of him like lip-syncing to Jeremiah while
okay. That's fair, and that might ruin things.
Honestly, it's lodged in my brain. I would also say I'm gonna hard disagree with you on the big reveal. The next interesting thing that happens with Melisandre will be the first.
Okay, I'm not a big Melisandre fan either. I'm not totally disagreeing with you, but it was interesting. Here's the other side. This show has an endpoint, and in my view, that endpoint is too close for it to continue moving at this glacial pace. I do not need to watch Arya train Daredevil style as a blind assassin. I need to see Arya as a badass assassin. Okay? I just don't need... We have been building up the Arya revenge storyline for 5+ seasons now. Just get there, for God's sakes. I don't need to see her have daily baton twirling practice at the seaside while she's blind and begging. I just don't need it. Montage it. Be done with it. How about this? Where in the hell is Bran?
I want to comment on that for just a second, because I do think, right, I mean, you know, if you're looking at these characters essentially as pieces on a chessboard, which I think the show sort of invites you to do, we understand that there's essentially preordained destinies for some of these characters. Like, we're close enough to the end that you can tell that there's an end game in mind, at least for many of them.
Yeah.
And so, for me, it's really hard to talk about needs. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need to see this because someone, you know, I feel like there's someone who understands where ultimately that fits in the story. And without that knowledge, it's hard to say what so-and-so needs to be doing. You know what I mean?
I'm just talking about experiencing it as a viewer.
Yeah.
Arya, who is, you know, from a macro view, my favorite character on this show. I just don't understand what is served by the slow rebuilding of her character.
I'm guessing that it's slow because she needs to be at a certain destination at a certain point in time.
Yeah,
right?
I guess I would almost rather just not see it then, because I'd rather find out, for instance, what is happening with Bran.
Really?
Yes.
You know what I'd rather find out than what's happening with Bran?
What?
Literally, what's happening with anyone else in Westeros?
Like, really?
I was hoping that they would take Bran and just sort of put him off to the side, and maybe we could check back with him when he's like 60.
But that's what. But he's got to play a part in this, and I don't even know where he is or what he's doing.
He was the guy that set the whole chain of thing in motion. He's a terrible character. He's entirely uninteresting.
Well,
I want nothing to do with him.
Then kill him.
Please kill him.
Okay, but he's not. But he's not dead, Madden. He's sitting underneath a tree somewhere.
I know.
We're presumably
Pastor Tim of Game of Thrones. Just kill him already.
All right, that would be fine. I'm not writing for Bran here. I'm just asking, why is this hanging chad of a storyline floating over here? It's kind of annoying to me.
Well, and clearly they're about to get, much to my dismay, they are about to get into the Bran storyline.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Well, you know, go ahead and throw a scene in the season premiere, if you don't mind. Just to check in, you know, because
next week. He's in next week. I don't know if you've seen him, by the way. He's grown like a foot and a half, I think.
I know. It's weird. It's weird. But I don't... There are so many storylines, and so few of them have anything actually happening right now.
I guess that's why my expectations are low for our first episode of the season, right?
Yeah.
You know, this established rhythm. You know that, like, the next to last episode is kind of where everything sort of typically builds to. And it takes the, you got to move the pieces around a little bit,
Yeah, but so move a piece. Because in this episode, the only piece that I really saw move was Sansa.
Yeah.
None of the other pieces moved. John's still lying on a damn table. What?
Khaleesi moved a little bit.
I guess. But she's still essentially in the same spot with a bunch of Dothraki that she can't trust that are taking her somewhere she doesn't want to go.
You had to get Jaime back from whatever island he was on.
And that actually, I thought, was one of the more impactful scenes of Jaime returning with the body of his daughter. I mean... But in general, there's...
I like when they were like, you know, it's only you and me. Like, we are all that we have. And I'm like, don't you guys have a kid together? He's like the king and stuff.
Yeah,
like,
but
what about him?
Well, but except him, right? that's the other thing. We don't know what's up with him because he's been corrupted by the High Sparrow. We don't even know if he's seen his mother. She just got walked naked through the streets with literal feces being thrown at her, and we don't know if he's come to see her. That hasn't been... There are so many things that I want to know about, and I feel like this episode spent so much time doing nothing. And that was frustrating to me. At the end of the day, though, and I don't know if you feel the same, for me, there's an element where even if it's not as great of a TV show as it was, it's got this, the Peter Jackson in Middle Earth feel for me, where I'll never stop because just going back to that world.
You're still watching House of Lies. Like, clearly, you're never going to stop.
Well, right, but I mean, I won't stop actually. I said that
like
it.
I'm not still watching House of Lies.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I'm still enjoying the being transported to Westeros, to all the places in this world. It's still so well done visually and artistically that I do feel like I get something out of it regardless. I just don't understand the need to keep slow playing things at this point.
I'm willing to trust that there's a grand design to the story. Understanding, the task that Benioff and Weiss, the showrunners of Game of Thrones, have had to deal with in terms of synthesizing these pretty massive books with with all of these characters and storylines,
which haven't even been written yet, by the way.
Yeah. But I'm just talking up to this point, right? When they were working off the source material.
Yeah. No, I know. I think it's even
so expertly that I'm just. Yes, it was not my favorite episode by any means, but I'm willing, they have so much rope with me. I have zero concern about the show's ability to entertain going forward. And, I can see how some might, given that we're, okay, this is the first episode really that, had the license to stray from the book, where we got past the book, but I trust these guys completely,
that trust is earned.
Completely excited to see where the story is going to go.
That trust is earned, I'm with you. I trust them as well. I have no reason not to, but I'm not. I am frustrated. How's that?
All right, fair enough.
I'm not out by any stretch of the imagination. I didn't even not enjoy myself. I have frustrations. I have some frustrations. That's all.
that is true. For as long as I know you, really.
Yeah, that's more of a general statement about my life than it is about Game of Thrones, I guess. All right, so we don't have time to get to this, but maybe just as homework, and I don't know that we'll even follow up on it. But a couple of women in my world, in the sports media world, a couple of Chicago ladies, which makes me even more proud of it, Sarah Spain and Julie DeCaro, shot this incredible video, and it's being called More Than Mean. It's a hashtag, and it's about just the treatment that women get on the internet, specifically women in the world of sports journalism, and specifically on Twitter. I think anyone who uses Twitter and isn't a psychopath realizes that it's tough out there for females on the internet. But I really think this video has a hell of an impact. It's 5 minutes long. Go ahead.
Yeah, not even. It's less than 5 minutes, I think.
Right.
It is impactful is a great way to put it. Like, it's really well done. The conceit of having men read these tweets to their faces.
Yeah.
It just plays really well.
Yep, and it speaks to how easy it is to say foul, repugnant things on the internet when you never have to face anyone over it, and you never even have to admit who you are in saying it. And you know, as someone who respects women and works and lives in the sports territory, this is something I have always been well aware of and have tried to point out at times. And you know, I think at some point, and I don't know how it happens, I don't know if it's even possible, but at some point, we're going to have to reckon as a culture, as a society, with internet toughness.
Keyboard warriors, I like to call them.
People who are completely comfortable saying the most foul thing they can think of to another person because of anonymity and because they feel protected by the distance between them and what's inside their computer. And it really is a scourge on our society. There really is no defense for it, and there's no two sides to this issue. There's no reaction to it but to be disgusted and somewhat horrified. And I don't know if anyone who writes that sort of filth would watch this video and stop doing it or change their mind, but I think it's important. I think it's an important issue, I think everybody should watch it.
I think there are a couple of things, you know, going on here. One being, I think, look, in general, we don't know how to talk to each other anymore.
Yeah.
I tweeted something about Kurt Schilling getting fired a couple of weeks ago.
Creep.
And I had some guy, you know, trying to argue with me. And honestly, look, I find pretty much every Kurt Schilling's view on everything to be pretty execrable. But I was really trying to keep it out of that, to be honest. And just from a perspective of a guy that, you know, manages a media operation.
Yep. And
to have an employee repeatedly, like on a literal daily basis, defying the company policy that you've disciplined him for on several of occasions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you earned your firing. But this guy wanted to argue with me, and he starts, you know, going in on all this stuff and whatever. I'm responding for a while. And finally, I was like, he's not even really listening to me. And he's starting in on the, I'm using facts, and you're just arguing with emotion. And I'm like, we're so clearly not in the same conversation right now. And you're just saying things that you've heard other people say in arguments.
Yep.
Like, we're not having a conversation. So
I'll tell you exactly what that is. I'll tell you exactly what that reaction is, because that to me is the worst part. Is that guy, who I don't know and didn't even see the tweets from, but that guy agrees with Kurt Schilling.
Right.
And that guy sees the world moving past his way of thinking. And the only way he knows to lash out against the world moving on from his way of thinking is to defend other people who think in his way.
Mm-hmm.
And it has nothing...
Not following me. Like, I guess just saw some sort of Kurt Schilling Twitter search and decided to, like, jump in on it.
That's right, because he sees that the majority of people in the conversation find his views objectionable. And he knows that he can't ride publicly for his views. So what he can do is ride publicly for Kurt Schilling and pretend that he has some sense of justice that has nothing to do with the opinions, but that is about whether or not we have free speech, or whether or not a man is allowed to speak his mind. And it's artifice, it's fake, and it's BS. Because all it is bigotry. And it's defending other bigots so that bigotry remains okay.
For my right to be a bigot.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with that. Look, people have a hard time letting go of being right. And then the other thing that I think, you know, happens, look, I think it happens to almost all women in media on Twitter, but in sports, I think it's particularly rampant because, let's face it, there are a lot of sports fans. There are a lot of you know, male sports fans who are very comfortable hanging out in that area.
It's one of the last refuges for rampant sexism. Yeah.
Well, and they're largely afraid of women and don't know how to relate to women and are comfortable in this area that's pretty much all dudes. And when a woman comes in and bathes their space, it literally, like, fries their brain. And this is why they say these awful freaking sexual things, because they don't understand and or have any ability to value women because they're scared of them.
It is literally childish behavior. What a child does when things are happening around them that confuse and upset them, a child lashes out in the most violent way they know how. And that
in the
is
third
what
grade,
these...
I stabbed this girl Vicky with a pencil.
There you go.
And it, like pretty hard. Like we had a big cut in her head because I had a crush on her and I didn't understand how to express that. Man.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
That's what this is.
Sorry
it's,
if you're out
it's...
there listening, Vicky. I figured that out later.
But that's what this is. It's the behavior of babies. It's the behavior of babies that don't know how to express themselves with reasonable discussion, and so they do it with violent imagery and disgusting comments. And I don't know that there's a solution. I don't know that anything can really be done about it, but the more we remind ourselves, and I'm not saying you need to spend your whole day reminding yourself about the awful things in the world, but when a video like this comes out, I think it's important to watch it because you do have to remind yourself sometimes that stuff is pretty messed up and people do some pretty messed up things. And just being aware of this sort of sickness, because it is, it's sick, being aware of it makes it harder for it to go unchecked.
And check it when you see it. I want to give some homework real quick because I know we got to go.
Okay.
But I watched the latest episode of Real Sports on HBO, which is just a consistently excellent show. Like really, like those guys are doing some, they're always doing original reporting. A lot of it is just fascinating. They did a piece on foul balls.
At
league ballparks. And you know, how many people have had their lives ruined with almost no legal recourse, right? Because there's all this sort of
stuff
language
on the back
on
of the
ticket that indemnifies you. Yeah. That part of it's interesting, but what I thought was really interesting, is what is Major League Baseball doing about it? And they contrast that by going to Japan to watch Japanese professional games.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they treat foul balls as a safety issue and, like, emphasis they put on it, it will stun you. Like, stun you.
Huh.
And it makes you, when you watch it, you go, wait, maybe we're the crazy ones.
All right.
I literally think someone is going to die from a foul ball at a major league ballpark. And then eventually we'll be doing what Japan's doing. But it's going to take that happening. There's, you know, part of that piece they spent some time with Chip Carey and Joe Simpson, who are, you know, the Braves announcers. And I have, you know, my list of issues with them is a mile long. We can do a whole podcast on it.
Let's not, though.
You know, but those guys describe a month in which they saw, you know, three serious foul ball injuries at different games. And they show all of, like, as they're telling the stories, you know, they go back and
show the video.
This stuff.
It's upsetting.
Like, it's traumatizing. It's,
yeah.
Like, the fact that this is going on all the time and we're not doing anything about it, like, it's one of those things you're going to look back and wonder. It's just, you know, it's take 10 minutes, watch that segment. It's the first segment of the show.
Okay. And why don't you watch Lemonade? Why don't you watch Lemonade and we'll circle back on Beyonce a bit as well?
All right. So, how do I can get Lemonade without being invested in Tidal? Because I'm just not doing that.
That's correct. You have to buy the album. We'll talk. I can explain it to you.
Okay. You figure it out, and I'll have the whole thing down by the time we get back next week.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.